Cain and Abel's story is for me one of the finest stories in the Bible because it has so many things one can bring to it. And I would just like to say that my punchline comes from reading this book by, or the beginning of this book by Otmar Kail and Sylvia Schreuer, in which they present a picture of biblical creation theology as not the way things are, but the way that things can be. And that is what I will try and present as my thesis for my talk, that as we look at the Bible's creation theology, it's not about the way things are, which are often tied to inductive reasoning, which is very scientific, but does not always work. The Bible's theology takes us to the way things can be. So we begin with the story of Cain and Abel. It's a very crucial text because in the series on Netflix, it follows the cliffhanger of the previous series, which ended up with God predicting certain things would happen, that humans would irreparably be changed. And if you look at your favorite statement of belief, you might find a statement of humanity that says humans are incapable of pleasing God. There were some fairly serious predictions in chapter 3 of the ground being cursed, and of the woman having trouble in childbirth, and that thorns and briars would now choke the agricultural produce and it would be hard to harvest. And in addition, perhaps our curiosity may be directed at this chapter's indicators of some clues about early humanity and the surroundings of early humans. And then we notice that Genesis chapter 4 sidesteps all of these issues. Eve doesn't have any difficulties in falling pregnant, neither does she have a 36-hour labor. And in fact, with one conception, many interpreters believe that the boys were in fact twins. The first thing Eve says was, "Thank you, Yahweh, for giving me this child." And so she appears to be a mom who is not removed from God's presence or in any way diminished in her awareness of God and the gifts that God brings. Another thing that's quite interesting, the boys have no difficulty in producing a lamb or a bunch of carrots to offer to God in worship. And I was so glad that Mark Granville told us about Deuteronomy's idea of celebration and feasting, that ties in very nicely with this chapter, that the boys knew that worship was good and that they had surplus as agricultural people wish for in order to bring their gifts to God. And also we might have found some indicators that the first humans lived in caves or were hunter-gatherers or killed animals for food. But in fact, we do see here a fairly advanced culture in which there are already the established agricultural divisions of shepherds and crop growers. We also find that there are cities. And this gives us a clue about the genre of the text. And as we are reminded, it's very hard to figure out the genre of the first chapters of Genesis, but at least one can say this is one of the very strong indicators that Genesis gives us on a regular basis, that it is written for a later audience and their concerns, but it is written in a context that is found in the past. And that is a very clever literary device we find in all forms of literature, a concern of the present set in the past. And this is exactly what we find with this story. But I'm interested in Genesis 4's theological vision. And the theological vision is driven by God's choice. God chooses one gift. He finds one gift acceptable, and he does not find the other gift acceptable. What will happen then? And I must just stress that many interpreters have noticed that in this chapter there is no indicator of merit on Abel's part. And please, if you have doubts about that, do recall that in Genesis 1:29, everything in creation eats grass, down to the cougars, the grizzly bears, everybody eats grass. In Genesis 2, there's also this vegetarian ideal of people living off trees. And Cain might have said, "Excuse me, I brought vegetarian gifts. Should I not be?" No merit. Let's not ask the merit question at this point. God's preferential activity is what drives the story of Cain and Abel. And alongside of that, we have a very strong conceptual parallel in the story of Jacob and Esau. And there again, there's a divine preference, which was given before their birth. And this is quite important, again, to stress that there is in God's mind a number of decisions that are taken without or apart from human merit. And so the question we have to wrestle with, why are we as Bible wrestlers given these inexplicable divine decisions to wrestle with? And the answer is because this is life. And I owe a lot of this to Walter Moberly's chapter in his book, A Theology of the Book of Genesis, which is very highly recommended as reading for scientists and theologians. And Moberly says this very eloquently, that the things we want most are things that are given in unequal measure and are determined before our birth and are determined without merit. Physical ability, the ability to have athletic skills. And those of us who teach always feel very saddened by students who tell us at the end of our course, when we've given them their grades, why did I work so hard, but I got a B, and my friend who goofed off all semester got an A from you. And this is just one of those things that many of us struggle with, is that we would like to have a lot sharper mental capacities, but we are not given them. And not because we merited or deserved it or did anything to deserve that. And similarly, I think in our culture also, things that we highly value are physical appearance, and those things are not given in equal measure or given according to merit. And then for us as scientists, we know that in the natural world also, things happen for no reason. Death and disease come unpredictably. Accidents happen. Our friends fall ill with degenerative genetic diseases that are not their fault. We see that people die because of natural disasters. And we find in the history of life, dead ends and extinction on a wide scale. And this is nature as we know it. This brings us back to Genesis 4. Did God ask Cain to do some soul searching? Cain, I would like you to ask yourself how this could have happened to you, or why I did this to you, or what would the causes have been for me to have not accepted your sacrifice? These, we know, are not useful questions, because the list that I've just given you are things in life and nature that are not connected to merit. And these kind of deductive questions, this is so because of this and this, focus on the way things are. So here's what I would like to put in the spotlight for us to perhaps question. Are questions relating to the way things are and the reasons behind them always the good questions to ask? And I would suggest no. And the trouble is that in the history of interpretation, Genesis 4 has been read in this way. For example, in the context, Genesis 4 should be about the post-fall conditions. Humans are fallen, alienated from God, because Cain's gift wasn't the best. It was not as good as Abel's, who included fat. Or Cain's heart was not right with God. He didn't bring the first things. And so humans are alienated from their fellow humans, and Cain murders his brother, and then God punishes but shows grace. So the story is often interpreted as a description of the way things are, a description of the human condition. But I would say, no, it is not. Cain is given options by God. The first conversation that Cain happens with God asks Cain these kind of questions. How may I move on? What strategies will help me to cope? These are the questions that focus on the way that lies open. And you will see I put an option two at that kind of question, which I think is the kind of question we can ask in the faith science conversation, questions that are not always dependent on rationalization. Because the point of Genesis 4 is that Yahweh invites Cain to find that open road. He asks Cain, and this is what we get from reading it in the Hebrew, why are you crestfallen? Something fell. His face may have fallen. If you do the right thing, there can be a lifting. So God says, there's a fallen situation. There can be a lifting. If you do the right thing, sin is crouching, but you can master it. And no one does a finer job at expounding this than John Steinbeck in his book, East of Eden. It's just the most brilliant exposition of this story found in the mouth of the Chinese man, Li. Now, the fact that Cain fails is not crucial for us because we do not have to be Cain. We can be like Esau. Just coming back to Jacob and Esau, if you read chapter 32, Esau overcomes his murderous intention. And he is just the most conciliatory, open-hearted, wonderful brother to have. And he weeps and he hugs his brother Jacob. We can be Esau. We do not have to be Cain because Esau found that open road and chose it. That brings me just now to contrast our two positions. Is Genesis 4 about the way things are? Do we have to read the Bible and science in terms of the way things are? Or can we read the Bible and science in terms of the way that lies open? And as a biblical scholar, I can encourage you to think that Genesis has more to say about our condition, as we were told this morning, and how we are to live. Those are forward-looking questions, rather than about our origins and evidence for what there is, because those are backward-looking questions, and they are not always very useful. And so just to summarize, a biblical theology of creation does not exist for legitimizing the way things are, for example, social hierarchies or explaining tragedy, but a biblical theology of creation presents the potential of a creation continually pleasing to God. And that's why we have vegetarian cougars in Genesis 1. We have a psalm that says, "Create in me a clean heart." It's something that can be renewed. And we have the lions and the lambs in various passages in Isaiah. And so Genesis 4, in relation to the faith-science conversation, perhaps you are like me, and the way that we look at life and evaluate it and look at nature sometimes leave us crestfallen. Why do the British Columbia blue grouse have to lay 40 eggs, but only 3 survive? Is that what a good God would have devised? Or just in the last 100 years, the Spanish flu killed more people than died in World War I. And so what I've found in my reading is that teleological or purpose questions posed to inexplicability are not always useful. But there are forward-looking questions. And Cain's story helps us to get away from the anxiety of having to reconcile the message of Genesis's earlier chapters and scientific knowledge about human origins. And instead, it tells us of what makes us truly human. What makes us truly great is that we have that choice. Thank you.
Time for questions. Questions for Dirk.
So I think you said this passage was written in the future, or the far future from the time it's apparently set. Would you like to explain a bit more about the period and, you know, the context of that?
Yes, I think in broad terms, we could recognize that Genesis was written for Israel, probably in the post-exilic era when their story had run its course, when they had seen their temple destroyed. They are in exile in Babylon and asking themselves, can God ever rebuild us? Can we ever rebuild what we had in the past? And Genesis speaks into these kind of things. One of the clearest clues is the fact that Abraham is described as coming from Ur of the Chaldeans, and nobody used the word Chaldeans until the 6th century before Christ. And so that's something the audience can recognize. The audience know who Yahweh is. The audience know what iron is, which only showed up in the 1200s BC. And the list goes on and on and on of the kinds of things the audience would know, but the story is set back in the past.
Thank you. That's interesting what you said about the focus of the text. However, in maybe I'm you know, broadening this in real life, often our decisions about the way forward are dependent on our perceptions, our understandings of causality, of why things have happened. How would you respond to that?
I agree. I think one has to ask causality questions, just like in the empirical sciences, one cannot do without causality questions and reasons. But I'm thinking perhaps more of the kind of questions Job would have had to ask, or the people writing the lament psalms, where God's choices are not explained. And asking why questions are not useful. So I think there are times when definitely those kind of questions do not help us. And it's better to say, what can I do since I am standing in this right now? What is it up to me to do looking forward?
Chris, what do you think of this interpretation? This comes from a Girardi interpretation, which looks at sacrificial solutions to the problem of escalating human violence. So if the question is, why does God approve Abel's sacrifice, animal sacrifice? Okay, it's not because this is the form of sacrifice he wants to endorse at this moment of history. It can't be. It's anachronistic. As you point out, it's vegetarian world until after the flood, and then animal sacrifice, as this establishes the way to stop the problem of human violence and human sacrifice. For Girard, the flood is a metaphor for human violence out of control. So what do you think of this? If the animal sacrificial offering by Abel is approved by God, this is proleptic. It's looking forward to the establishment of sacrifice after the flood. In this sense, it's anachronistic to say it's being established now. No, that's not until later. Like with Abraham and Isaac, we want animal sacrifice to replace human sacrifice. After the flood, we want animal sacrifice to control the problem of human violence. Right now, it's just God saying this should be the stopping point in an escalating rivalry, like that between twins. So if escalating rivalry begins with vegetarians, it's not going to stop there. God will say, no, it has to stop at animal sacrifice, because the next logical point is going to be human sacrifice, human violence. And that's going to be the problem that has to be solved after the flood. What do you think of this reading of the text? Is it sustainable? Have you heard it before? It's one that I've become fascinated by.
I have not heard of it. If I could classify it, it belongs to the interpretations that focus on the sacrifice, right, and not on God's decision and the human choice that results from that. So I think that would be in fine company, but I would like to say the focus of the text is in the inexplicable decision and the unfairness of it.
As an engineer, I like to read about the descendants of Cain who made musical instruments and invented metallurgy and did other good things. And often we teach that this is a good advance. And yet, on the other hand, we get teaching that it was the line of Seth that was godly, and the line of Cain was ungodly and worldly and making these things and turning away from God. So, and Lamech and his brutality. So should we welcome and value technological things and talk about Jubal in a good voice, or should we say, no, this is worldly and we need to turn to the godly line of Seth?
Excellent question. John Goldingay, in his book Genesis for Everyone, handles that very sensitively, because, of course, human culture should not be devalued. And those are the things that stand out as being worthy. Music, having pretty girls as daughters. I know I have them myself. And being able to bring two pieces of iron together is a fascinating thing. But at the same time, perhaps there is a questionability in how highly we value our technology and our culture. And perhaps there's just a slight ambiguity in the fact that that was not the line that continued. as the chosen line. The line of Seth was chosen. Very good question.
Okay, yeah. My question is that where can you put the Bronze Age and the Neolithic and the Paleolithic Age in the story of the Genesis?
The question is, should we put those ages into the story of Genesis at all? And I think I would begin by saying a story is written for an audience. And where do we find the audience? And the audience we find in the Iron Age, in Iron 2 to be precise. Mm-hmm. And for them, I think those kind of divisions that are of concern to us were beside the point. That would be my short answer. And mm-hmm. I'd love anyone else to jump in if you like. Mm-hmm. There were some questions on that side.
So, in the interpretation of why did God accept one offering and the other, the three basic interpretations are that it's arbitrary, there's no knowledge of that, and that's irrelevant to the point, or that God is valuing one form of culture over another. But the third is that there are these clues about the fatlings and the first, brachot, for the firstlings and so forth. But so what I want to get into is that when you drew the analogy with the Esau and Jacob story, you said that God decided through the oracle in chapter 25, verse 23. But if you read the oracle carefully, it doesn't have a direct object marker before the younger or the older. So it could be read the younger will rule the older or the older will rule the younger. It's actually ambiguous in Hebrew. So it actually leaves the decision to the parents to choose sides. And I would suggest that text is not just about God's decision, it's about human decision. What do you think of that?
I'll have to check your Hebrew.
It's correct. You mentioned a lot of commentaries. What does that have to do with Hebrew? When a noun is the object of a verb, there's a direct object marker. And a name is a direct object. But this is in poetry, since poetry doesn't have direct object.
I'll answer your question in an hour. But maybe one can just say that Esau had every reason to want to kill his brother. He was maltreated. He had every reason to have the same kind of resentment, but he overcame his resentment. Yeah.
Any other questions? This will be the last question.
I saw many years ago a medieval play that dealt precisely with the question of why did God prefer one offering over the other? Because God doesn't give a reason. But the writer of the play did. And in the play, Cain gives the very best of the meat he has produced, the absolute best. Excuse me. While the other brother, gosh, am I getting my brothers mixed up here? The vegetarian brother, the brother who grew the plants, didn't bring his best. He kept his best produce behind. And instead brought some old, moldy, old, rust-infected wheat kind of thing. And I'm sure that made sense to the medieval audience. And I think we do, still, in these times, question that. How come, God? Why did you do that?
I think perhaps we owe that interpretation largely to the New Testament and to later Judaism, who were focused on the act of bringing. And certainly that's why we have a very strong tradition of this, that the fault lay in the bringing or in the product that was brought. It was not the best. So either the fault lay in Cain's gift or it lay in Cain's heart. And those are established traditions, and that certainly is what we find in the New Testament. But to be fair, in Genesis seems to be reticent in telling us why, because it wants to perhaps lead us deeper into the question of unexplained decisions.
Okay, let's thank our speaker. Thank you, Dirk.